Welcome to another episode of Cattlecast, presented by Capital Area District Libraries. It's the podcast that provides a nice mix of information and entertainment. Here's your host, Mark Bazita.
Welcome to another episode of Cattlecast. March is reading month, so we invite you to check out all of the fun activities planned at Capital Area District Libraries. Just visit our website at cadl.org for details. Congratulations to Tylene Walker, who won a Kindle Fire for knowing last month's keyword, which was app. Now keep listening for this month's keyword for your chance to win a family four-pack of movie passes. We have some great interviews coming your way, including gospel star Brian Poppin and speedy delivery for Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood, David Newell. We'll get started right after this.
It's National Reading Month, so stop by the Capital Area District Libraries and meet some of your favorite storybook characters like Peter Rabbit and Dinosaur. Get the complete schedule at cadl.org. That's cadl.org.
RB Digital is a service that allows you to download magazines like Highlights, 17, HGTV, and Forbes for free with a library card. Capital Area District Libraries. Everything right here.
The festivities carry on for our 20th series. Today we're talking with a manga artist and children's author of works like Brody's Ghost and the Mastering Manga series. He has visited us not once, but twice in the summer of 2012 during summer reading and spring 2013 for our author series. Now we're joined by author and illustrator Mark Crilly. Mark, welcome to Cattlecast.
Thanks so much for having me.
You're perhaps best known for your graphic novel, Brody's Ghost, which you wrote and illustrated. Now, if you had to choose, would you be exclusively an illustrator or an author?
Oh, wow, that's a tricky question. You know, I think art was the first thing that came to me. I was fascinated with drawing as a kid, and it still probably comes most easily to me compared to writing. But I feel very lucky I don't have to choose between the two, and especially with comics, you are really interchanging constantly between the drawing and the writing, and that's really what I love.
Who are your biggest influences as an author and as an illustrator?
Well, the art influences came first, and I have memories of going to see an exhibition of M.C. Escher at the Detroit Institute of Art when I was a kid, and it just blew my mind. And my father bought a book of his artwork, and I used to make copies of them. And so Escher was a huge influence. And in terms of writing, one of the most direct influences was a mentor of mine back in college, David Small, who is one of Michigan's greatest children's book authors and illustrators. I should say one of the world's greatest. He's certainly top tier in that regard. But I was lucky to study under him when he was working on a children's book called Imogene's Antlers, and I pored over that thing, and I think I learned a lot about writing and illustrating from him at that time.
Now, you taught English in Taiwan and Japan for 5 years. How did that experience shape your work?
That's right. I went directly to Taiwan straight out of college, taught there for a year and a half, then later did 2 years in Japan, and then after that returned to Taiwan for one further year. Japan in particular almost kind of took over my life in terms of my creative work. My very first comic was called Akiko on the planet Smoo. It was about a young Japanese American girl. And then Miki Falls, which was the, as I recall, it was the series I was working on when I first went there to the Capital Area District Library. And that one is just kind of a love letter to Japan, Miki Falls is. And even Brody's Ghost has a lot of Japanese influence, so it's been very far-reaching, that influence over the years.
You were raised in Detroit and attended Kalamazoo College. Have you or would you ever incorporate Michigan into your work?
Hey, that's a great question, and as a matter of fact, I've got a new project that is underway. I'm going to be working on it later this year, a graphic novel project. And it does involve a Michigan location. I'm going to have a sort of cottage by the lake in northern Michigan figure rather prominently in the story. So that that might be my first direct reference to Michigan, although I think you'll see little bits of it seeping into my work regardless, just because I really was pretty much, if not born, then raised from like the age of one in Michigan. And then, I've settled down here, so it's a big part of my life.
Now, we've hosted you twice at Cattle, and you often do visits in libraries throughout the state. Do you have any interesting stories about your library visits from the fans or attendees that you encounter?
Wow, that's a great question, and I wish I had a good story to just throw out there. You know, but I certainly have been in some unusual situations and have been invited to anime conventions that are held at libraries, in which case half the audience seems to be doing cosplay. I don't know if you're familiar with that term, and they're all dressed up, and you find yourself answering a question that was asked by someone, you know, dressed head to toe in a Spider-Man costume,
right.
And you have to keep a straight face, even though you have no idea who it is you're really talking to.
And finally, what projects are you working on right now?
My very latest book is just about to come out, is simply entitled Chibi, and it's an instructional art book that focuses on the Japanese cute cartoony characters that are referred to as chibis. They have large heads and tiny bodies and super exaggerated facial expressions. That one will be out within the next month or two. Another book that I just completed but is not yet going to be in stores for a while yet is more of a traditional pencil drawing book, which is sort of interesting. I've done a lot of these how to draw books, but it's only now that I've finally done what I think of as a traditional pencil drawing book, and it focuses on how you can use an ordinary pencil in combination with a black colored pencil to create artwork of great beauty. And the idea, it's kind of I have a bee in my bonnet about it, this idea of kids who feel they have to blow a lot of money on art supplies in order to create great art. And so I've created a book that says, no, you don't need to have a lot of money to make great art. Just two humble little pencils is all you need. And, of course, the many hours of practice. So that one is not coming out yet for, I would think, like another at least 6 or 9 months or something like that, but it's on the way.
Mark, thanks so much for spending time with us today.
Well, thank you so much. I'll always have a place in my heart for the Capital Area District Library, and for Trent Smiley in particular, who brought me out there. Really super happy memories every time I did a visit there.
That's Mark Crilly, author of Brody's Ghost, the Mastering Manga series, and more, all of which are available to borrow from our catalog at cadl.org. Stay tuned for more great interviews on Cattlecast. Thousands of music albums are checked out from Cattle Branches and our Hoopla Digital online service. This includes music from my next guest. He became a piano protege in his early teens, has written songs for Chaka Khan and NSYNC, and is now a successful gospel music artist. I am pleased to welcome Brian Little Boy Wonder Poppin to Cattlecast. Hello, Brian.
Hey, man. How you guys doing?
Excellent. Thanks. How did you get the nickname Little Boy Wonder?
Yeah, it's kind of weird, man, because I'm, like, older now, of course, so the term Little Boy Wonder is kind of funny, but it's my publishing name, and also is the name of the label that we started. And to be really honest and blunt, I mean, there is a legend and the one and only Stevie Wonder that I got to meet in New York City. I used to live in New Jersey, and I used to commute from Jersey to New York, either by train or drive-in, and, you know, deal with all that traffic and all that. And I would work with an old-school R&B funk producer. And, I mean, this guy taught me the ropes. It was like going to college, but, you know, just the school of hard knocks, and taught me what real music was about, and just soul music and old-school R&B and funk and leaving the grit and not editing files to make it perfect. I mean, he just was an amazing, amazing musician. and lover of soul music. And so while I was kind of sitting under his, you know, workmanship, a lot of people came through his studio and in and out of his home. And one day I was hanging out at the studio and he goes, "You'll never guess who's coming over." And I was like, "Okay, oh." And knock on the door, open Stevie Wonder and his brother. And I thought it actually was like a costume, like a birthday thing. I didn't know what was going on, but it was the real Stevie Wonder. So anyway, long story short, we hung out with him, jammed with him, you know, just joked with him. And it was just amazing. He took us out to dinner in the limo, like 15 people. Went and ate at the Blue Ribbon in New York City, and just a beautiful, beautiful spirit. And so to answer your question, I got that name because my buddy, who's this producer, put this little clip of I Can Make It, which at the time was just a music band, but it's bump, 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 bump. So he played in this little clip that I wrote, and he goes, "What do you think of that?" And Stevie starts shaking his head, as of course we know he does. And he goes, "Oh, man, who that? That's the Little Boy Wonder's music. That's Little Boy Wonder." And so that's how I got my nickname. So I figured out I'm going to keep the name even though I'm older now because Stevie gave it to me.
Absolutely. What a great story, though. That's what a great experience. So having worked with secular artists like Chaka Khan and NSYNC, why did you decide to become a gospel artist?
You know, it's not so much that I just decided to. I've always lived in the church. Even as a concert pianist, churches would have me in when I was in my teens just to, like, do a few specials on piano. And it was always a goal of mine to connect, you know, not just musically, but heart to heart. Anytime I, you know, performing live. And it wasn't always even a performance. It was a performance for God. I mean, I just tried to have excellence in anything I did because I knew that, it was a gift he had given me even at a young child's age. And even though I was in the church most of my life, you know, I still was writing and producing for a season, like I, you know, mentioned. And I just knew in my heart I was supposed to use this gift for God in some way. And I just didn't feel right and at peace with what I was doing, the commute to New York and, you know, being around all these artists and secular artists. I mean, it was cool, and I learned a lot. And some of them actually are amazing, amazing people and beautiful people and very talented and gifted people. But I just knew it just wasn't where I was supposed to be. So I moved to Nashville, Tennessee with my wife and, you know, creating more of a family. And I just went through the process of trying to figure out who I was, what I was doing, what I was called to do. And in that process, songs were birthed because of a lot of hardships, a lot of conflict, pain, insecurities. And so, these songs, I just felt honestly like I wasn't good enough to do them. And so I knew a lot of people in the gospel genre. And so I reached out to them, and I was like, "Hey, I got this song for you. What do you think?" And they all loved it. But just for some reason, it didn't work out for them to do it. And the more I tried to push the songs on other people, God was working on me to say, "Look, I don't need you to be perfect. I like you broken. I like, you know, your passion." And I just was remembered, of David. And I do have a big heart for God, and I do want to encourage people. And he was just working on me. And so I realized I was the best person to do these songs. And, you know, lo and behold, here we are now.
Now, last year, you released the album I Got Out, and it was number one on Billboard's top gospel and top Christian charts. How does that feel?
Yeah, man, I mean, you say number one, and I almost in my mind feel like you're saying it about somebody else. It's just hard to process, even. We worked hard. God blesses what you give them, and you can't just sit on the couch. I'm a hard worker. I'm driven. I give 110, and anybody that sees me live knows that I'm pretty intense. You know, I've always loved Ty Trivet and Kirk Franklin and Israel Houghton, and, you know, they're real passionate people, energetic people. And, I traveled from church to church. I went places for free. I went places, you know, to give back to them. I didn't care. I just went everywhere. And to me, it's always been about relationships. So we obviously sold a lot of pre-sales and sold a lot of the record, and to know that it's connecting with people, I mean, that's the biggest, you know, as an artist, as a musician, as a writer, to know that the songs are connecting with people, it's just amazing, man. It's a blessing. I'm very, very thankful.
Now, on the title song, I Got Out, what is the lyric you wrote, "I've been through the fire, but I got out"? What does that mean to you?
Yeah, I mean, well, it's kind of symbolic. you know, when I was going through a lot of the process, which is usually not fun, but I was having to deal with insecurities of me feeling like I wasn't good enough or couldn't sing like maybe so-and-so or deliver the song as best as so-and-so, or God, how could you use me? How could you do this? How could you do that? And I just had to let it all go. And the more I did and the more I let God get the glory and the credit for it and worship, honestly, just learning how to get on my knees and worship and just let God do it. He started connecting the dots. And I got out was birthed because at 2 a.m., I was just, we'd almost finished recording a song, which turned into I Got Out. And I realized, oh my goodness, like all these things, like I almost declared bankruptcy. I almost basically, I for like months couldn't play the keys. And keys has always been my voice, really. But I had like this carpal tunnel thing going on in my wrist. And all this stuff was going on. My marriage years ago was not doing well because I was prioritizing things wrong. My marriage was third on the list instead of first. I was putting my career and my music first, and that was wrong. But God gave me the grace to work it out, to turn it around, to reprioritize things. And I just was overcome with his joy and thankfulness because he gave me the grace to work it out. You know, he gave me a second chance. And thankful I didn't declare bankruptcy. Thankful that he allowed me to start a label. And thankful he put people in my path. And I just, man, I couldn't. Oh, I was overcome with joy. And so I just, in my belly, man, I heard this. I've been through the fire, but I got out. And I just had a little praise moment at 2 a.m. in my studio in my basement for almost 45 minutes. I danced, I shouted. And the next morning I woke up with bruises on my heels. And it just, it was all worth it, man. I was just thankful.
Wow. Well, you mentioned Kirk Franklin and certainly Stevie Wonder. Who are some of your other musical influences?
Wow. I mean, I can't just name one, but like, of course, Stevie Wonder, Michael Jackson. I mean, I love some rap music, man. So like Run DMC, Prince has always been, and if we can call him an icon, even though I know that's not really the right Christian term, but I just love good music. I've always loved soul music. You know, my dad used to spin vinyl records like Donny Hathaway and the Commodores and Miles Davis. And then my mom was like a church choir director. So I was raised in the church and, you know, she loved like Richard Smallwood and Kirk Franklin stuff and just the old school choir ensemble music. So I had a lot of that in my world and it took me a moment, you know, to realize who I was. But, you know, even today, I still like Justin Timberlake or Beyonce or, you know, Bruno Mars. I mean, I just like good music. So sometimes that might be that, and sometimes it might just be some real peaceful classical piano music.
Tell us about the new single, Step in the Name.
Well, I call it feel-good music because it's got a little funk, it's got a little pop, it's got a little grit, and it's got a little gospel. So, you know, everybody needs to put on a song that kind of just takes them somewhere and you kind of forget about the world that you live in, which sometimes is good and sometimes is bad and sometimes is not fair. But the whole point of the song for me was to put it on, let go, and let God. And you know, you've got to give God something to work with. And in my own life, which is the only way I can connect, is to be honest with people and share what I've been through. And you know, you can't just sit on the couch. You've got to give God something to work with. You've got to invest or speak faith or go out on a limb and try this or try that and whatever you're passionate about. And I know he will work it out and he'll bless you. All I can do is share, you know, my story. But I feel like step in the name is step in love, you know, step in faith, step, just do something. It's not so much dance. Although like I gave you a little feel-good music for the process, it's more about get out your box, do something, and be the light. And honestly, you know, growing up in the New York, New Jersey area, the culture is so important to me, and diversity is so important to me, and I love it. I love creativity. I love people, all shades, all cultures. And so step in the name to me is also, can we step together in unity? You know, can we join hands? Can we forgive more? Can we love more in spite of what we look like or what you look like? Can we come together and step?
Absolutely. Brian, where can people find your music?
Well, if you like to buy digital music or stream music, you know, you can go to YouTube, you can go to Spotify, iTunes, Apple Music, Google Play. title, all that stuff. You just type in Brian, B-R-Y-A-N, Poppin, P-O-P-I-N, and it's not two P's, so P-O-P-I-N. And, you know, you'll find a bunch of music, like Step in the Name, I Got Out, Such a Time as This, I Can Make It. If you want physical CDs, we can still ship that to you. You can get it at Walmart or Walmart.com, or also you can go to my website, which is Brian, B-R-Y-A-N, Poppin, P-O-P-I-N.com. Click on store and, you know, find some stuff that maybe you'll want there.
Well, and Brian's music is also available through our branches and Hoopla. Just visit our catalog at cadl.org. Thanks for joining us, Brian, and continued success to you.
Thank you, man. I appreciate your time. Appreciate it.
And Cattlecast continues right after this.
Celebrate Capital Area District Library's 20th birthday. We're giving Cattlecast listeners a chance to win great prizes, like a Kindle Fire or a pair of tickets to see The Lion King. Just listen for the special keyword during new episodes of Cattlecast. When you hear it, email it to connect@cadl.org, along with your contact information. Winners will be announced during the following month's episode. Each month, a new keyword will be announced, so keep listening to the Cattlecast podcast.
Heidi Butler is Cattle's local history librarian. Hi, Heidi, and welcome to Cattlecast.
Hi, Mark.
So first, tell us about the local history room. Where is it? When is it open? That sort of thing.
Well, the local history room is located in the lower level of the downtown Lansing Library, and our current hours are Wednesdays from noon to 8 p.m., Fridays from 9 a.m. to 1 p.m., and the third Saturday of each month from 10 a.m. to 2 p.m.
Okay. So if people were to come down there, what are some of the things that they can see? I mean, the local history room is enormous, but give us just a quick overview of just some of the possibilities of things people can research and check out in the local history section.
Your first experience of the local history room, if you've never been in there before, is the room itself, which was modeled after the Victorian parlors of old Lansing mansions. So we have beautiful wallpaper, old portraits on the wall, a chandelier, and a sort of a feeling of old times when you come in. A lot of people enjoy that. When you come in, probably one of the more common things that people research is the history of their house. So we have lots of different resources that allow you to do that. We'll probably talk about that a little more later.
Sure.
But we have subject files, biographical files, anything that happened over the course of history in Lansing and Ingham County, we might have some record of that. We have the county history books and those kinds of things. And a lot of photographs, too, photographs and postcards that people like to look at.
Mm-hmm. Now, some of those bigger collections that are housed, you mentioned like the history of homes or things like that, but tell us about a little bit more specifically about some of those larger collections.
Well, let's see. We could start by talking about the subject and biographical files again. That's a ready reference collection that you can access right when you walk in the room. They live in filing cabinets, and everything is alphabetical in broad subject categories that are labeled on the drawers. And so that way, you know, you don't have to request those things or have a special permission. You can just help yourself. It's a great way to get started on a topic. Some of our other collections, you do need to work with staff to talk about what you're interested in researching, and then we can let you know what kind of collections we have and pull those things from the back in our storage areas. The real estate collection that most people like to use, called Stebbins, that one has over 350 boxes. So we have to keep that on the shelves in the back. It's just too big. But out there in the room, you can also find high school yearbooks for Lansing. You can find city directories, which are annual directories, kind of like the telephone book, where you can look up a person's name or an address over the years. We also have the Lansing School District board minutes, and we have city council proceedings on the shelves out there that people can look at.
That's an impressive collection.
Yeah.
So you mentioned about researching the history of your home, and I know especially this past year, that's been a really hot topic, but so how does someone who wants to research their home begin doing that?
One of the first things we direct people to would be the Ingham County Assessor website. And unfortunately, that one has a complicated URL that's not very easy to spell out. But if you search for Ingham County Assessor on Google or something like that, you can find the website. And that allows you to search by address. So you would put your address in there. And that results for your address will tell you the year that your home was built. That's pretty accurate coming from the city assessor. From that point, when you know what year your home was built, you can go to the city directories. And again, those are annual directories, kind of like a phone book. You can look up that address and follow it through the years and find out who lived in the home. One thing a lot of people like to do is kind of put together the biography of their house. Mm-hmm. So, for example, if someone who was in management at Oldsmobile lived in their house for a certain part of time, they maybe would search for a portrait of that person and hang it on the wall in their home, or find out the story of that person's family to kind of help understand what that house, what might have happened in that house over time. That's just one angle. Of course, the real estate collections also include photographs. So if we look up your address in our either our Stebbins or our Beilon real estate collections or the Lansing City Assessor files, we can find photographs of your home from usually sometime between the 30s and the 70s. We will have a photo on file for most homes in Lansing and even Ingham County.
Now, where did these photos actually come from then?
The two real estate agencies for whom we have collections, they did similar to what's on Zillow or any of the real estate websites that we look at today. Mm-hmm. They did listings with little 3x5 cards, and on the back side of each card was a photo of the home. So people went and drove around and took snapshots of the homes, and then they were advertised for sale. So yes, the photographs are there, but then on the back side, you find out how many bedrooms did it have, what kind of exterior finishing was on the house, does it have a garage or any special outbuildings, anything about the landscaping, all kinds of details for whatever point in time that home was on the market.
Okay. Yeah. Now, some of this information people would have to come into the library, into the local mm-hmm. history room for, but there's a lot of things and a growing collection of things available through mm-hmm. the CATL website as well, right?
That's correct. The whole entire collection of Lansing City Assessor photographs that we have been digitized. Those are available online. It's a little bit of a complicated search process because you have to know the old parcel number, but our website for the record for the city assessor files has information on how to figure out what the old parcel number was, and there's also some index information to the photos. So if you're willing to put in a little bit of time, you'll probably be able to find a photo of your home there.
Wow.
Yeah.
that's really a neat collection.
Yeah.
And so how can you just give a quick link for people to go to just to at least
sure.
get that started?
The homepage for all the Lansing and actually all of our CATL local history material online is cadl.org/LHonline.
LH Online. Okay, mm-hmm. very cool. So now, if people wanted to get in touch with you, whether it's mm-hmm. for a history of their home or countless other local history type questions, what is the best way for them to do that?
We've got a few different options. You can email localhistory@cadl.org. That's all one word, local history. You can call 517-367-6313. We also have a CATL Local History Facebook page, and some customers prefer to contact us through that Facebook page, which we are on it every day and always respond to those, too.
And posting some really cool photos,
yes,
too.
Yes,
that's
we did.
Great fun to follow that, for sure. Now, if somebody's listening to this and says, hey, you know, I've got this collection of such and such at home, mm-hmm. or my great-grandfather had this or whatever, are you always actively seeking materials mm-hmm. and donations?
Yes, or? Absolutely. Our collections are pretty much built based on donations. So without those kind of gifts from our community, we wouldn't have local history to share. So we always encourage any kind of donation that people are interested in making. And I am happy to discuss that with people anytime to talk about what they have and, you know, how it might be used for research and those kinds of things.
Okay. Yeah. Well, very cool. Lots of great stuff in local history. And you could probably get lost and spend hours mm-hmm. and days yeah. in there, really, if you wanted to. Again, could you give us the hours of the local history room one
sure.
more time?
Sure. Wednesdays from noon to 8, Fridays from 9 a.m. to 1 p.m., and the third Saturday of each month from 10 a.m. to 2 p.m.
That sounds great. And one last thing before we go, Heidi, can you tell us this month's CATL keyword?
I would be happy to. It's history.
All right. History is this month's CATL keyword, so email that keyword along with your name and telephone number to connect@CATL.org. That's connect@CADL.org, and have a chance to win some great prizes. Heidi Butler, thanks for joining us.
Thanks, Mark.
David Newell has worked with the Fred Rogers Company since September 1967, when production began on the very first national broadcast of Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood. He has served as Director of Public Relations for the Fred Rogers Company, but is probably best known as Mr. McFeely, the speedy delivery man in the neighborhood. David Newell joins me now on Cattlecast as part of our 20 for our 20th series. Hello, David, and welcome.
Hello, and speedy delivery.
Great to talk to you again.
Well, that's good to talk to you, Mark. As you well know, it's our 50th anniversary, 50 years of Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood on public television. So I'm busy this year talking to people, letting them know all about what we're doing.
Absolutely. Well, let's go back a little bit and talk about how did you first meet Fred Rogers?
Well, it goes back to, let's see, September of 1967. I was in Europe the summer of 1967 visiting my cousin who was in the Navy at the time, and I went over to tour Europe, and on $5 a day you could do it then, and spend some time with him. During that time, I had a telegram from a mutual friend of Fred Rogers and mine. He said in his telegram that the neighborhood is going to go national because Sears Roebuck Foundation gave money to do it. So, and he said in the telegram, and I set up a meeting with you, with Fred Rogers, when you get back. So I said, oh, fine. I didn't know what to expect. So I went in to meet Fred, and we talked for an hour, I'd say. And he hired me to work as a production assistant and being in charge of the props and costumes and all of that. And he said, oh, by the way, I also would like you to do the part of the delivery man of the neighborhood. I'm going to open the program up a little bit, and we're going to add some cast members. And this way, I won't have to bring in props or things to show the children. You will have them delivered by you. And your name will be Mr. McCurdy. Hmm. And that was my name. It took us about 5 months to get a little backlog of programs. And the day we were going to tape, the phone rang. And it was the Sears Roebuck Foundation, and they said, could you not call the delivery man Mr. McCurdy? It looks like it's too self-serving. Fred came back into the studio, and I was in my costume ready to go. He said, oh, we have to get you another name. And before he finished his sentence, he said, McFeely, that's your name. Your name will be Mr. McFeely, because that's his middle name.
That's right.
And so here I am, Mr. McFeely. Yeah, sort of in a nutshell, how I met Freddie, hired me, and renamed me as Mr. McFeely.
Yeah. Well, now, there were close to 900 Mr. Rogers Neighborhoods made from 1968 to 2001. Tell us a little bit about production of the show, how it worked and even evolved over the years.
Well, it evolved in the first 2 years were in black and white. No, the first year was black and white. We did 130 programs in black and white. Fred would start with the scripts, and I would be doing collecting props and so forth for those scripts. And then when we ready the tape, we do the locations, and then we come to the studio and do the neighborhood of make-believe.
Yeah.
And then we do the openings and closings on another day. So we worked sort of from the inside out in a way. And then they would be edited and then sent to PBS, and they aired them from the Washington, D.C. Distribution Center. And so our season of taping was, I'd say, from about September to the following May or June. And Fred would go and write a year's worth of scripts in the summer.
Yeah.
And then we'd come back in September and the process would start again. We did that for years and years, and it was really a wonderful experience.
You know, you welcomed so many guests over the years,
yes,
too. I mean,
yes.
Yo-Yo Ma, Julia Child, LeVar Burton. But one of the guests that I remember that you helped bring to the program was none other than the Wicked Witch of the West from The Wizard of Oz, Margaret Hamilton. Tell us a little bit about that experience, and also the experience with Bill Bixby and Lou Ferrigno from The Incredible Hulk.
Oh, okay. Well, I'll start with Margaret Hamilton. You know, we had a lot of people would tell me, adults that is, would tell me, boy, when I, that Wicked Witch and those monkeys scared me. Because they showed the program on network television once a year.
Right.
You know, it was a big special broadcast. And also, Fred was doing a program. He wanted to do something about demystifying scary things for young children. I'm talking about preschoolers,
right,
who are afraid of, they don't separate the fantasy and the reality. So Fred, through television, wanted to help them do that. So I said, you know, why don't we do a program about the Witch and the Wizard of Oz? And she's an actress, and she's still working, quite busy. At the time, she was doing Maxwell House coffee commercials, as well as still doing character parts. And Fred said, well, if you can find her, I'll write the script. It turned out her grandchildren watched Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood.
Ah.
And so I located her, and she came to do the segment, and she showed children how she put the hat on and put the costume on and did her cackle. I didn't put the makeup on, the green makeup, but she explained that she was an actress, and that was her job. And it's sort of very, very matter-of-fact. Just explaining a costume and how she got into it and how she pretended that she was the witch.
Well, and similar concept with Bill Bixby and Lou Ferrigno from The Incredible Hulk, right? That was the same concept.
Oh, yes, well, had the same idea. Our daughter that time, when she was about 3 years old, and the Hulk was on broadcast television at that time, around 8 o'clock at night, and she happened to see it. She had nightmares as a result of seeing it. So I told Fred, you
know, right.
So we were going to demystify that again. And so we went to the Universal Studios, and Bill Bixby met us. When Bill Bixby's character turned into the Hulk, he was very mad, and he would destroy things when he was mad. And Fred was using that as an example of showing that there are ways of dealing with your anger.
Absolutely.
You know, you don't destroy things, you don't hit somebody, but alternative ways,
right, right,
of dealing with your anger. And one day we showed the children Lou getting into the makeup chair at Universal and getting the green paint put on his face and the wig and the false forehead and so forth, demystifying that he was an actor, and
right,
he was showing, getting into a costume, and also we dealt with the anger portion of it, too. So that was Fred's style, just by showing.
Oh, absolutely. Well, as you mentioned, this is the 50th anniversary of Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood, and
right,
one last question for you. What can you tell us about the upcoming theatrical films about Fred Rogers? There's the documentary that's due out this June, and the Tom,
yeah,
Hanks film that begins filming this fall.
Well, I can tell you more about the theatrical documentary, because that's finished, and it's really more about, I think, Fred's philosophy of life and his thoughts about children and maybe how he dealt with certain topics. That's the general tone of that theatrical documentary.
Right.
That's not to be confused with the Tom Hanks movie that, as you said, won't be starting till the fall. I don't know too much about that. Can probably expect to see that sometime in 2019.
Thank you so much for everything.
Well, thank you, Mark. And now I'm going to count to three, and we're both going to say speedy delivery, all right?
All right, that sounds good.
Here we go. One, two, three.
Speedy delivery. You can check out Fred Rogers' information, books, and more in our catalog at cadl.org. And for more information about Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood, visit their website at fredrogers.org. David Newell, thank you so much.
At your Capital Area District Libraries, everything is right here. And now you can access thousands of films on demand with Canopy. Choose from hundreds of new films each month, available on a variety of devices and platforms. Your Cattle Card provides free access to thousands of films, from award-winning documentaries to hard-to-find titles and classics. It's the world's finest cinema, now free to you. From your Capital Area District Libraries, celebrating 20 years of providing great service. Log on to cadl.org today.
And we're on location now at Wharton Center in East Lansing, and our guest today is Maggie Latkis, the star of Something Rotten, playing now through Sunday at Wharton Center. Welcome to CattleCast, Maggie.
Thank you so much for having me.
So tell us about Something Rotten.
Something Rotten is a musical. It's a musical comedy. It takes place in the Renaissance, and we always like to caution people. We say that don't get worried. There isn't going to be any language barrier. There isn't going to be any. It's as a very modern, like, sense of humor. This is the same people who brought the same team that brought you Book of Mormon and Aladdin. So these people know how to do musical comedy. So yes, it's a very modern sense of humor, and it is about these two brothers who are writers, and their biggest competition in the theater scene is Shakespeare. He's literally like the rock god of theater, and it's played by Adam Pascal. So you are going to get rock god. They're trying to compete with Shakespeare, and the older brother Nick goes to a soothsayer, and he asks him what the future of musical theater would be, and the soothsayer tells him that the future of theater will be musicals. Nick and Nigel set out to write the first musical, and hilarity ensues.
Well, that sounds great. So in this role as B, you get to play opposite your husband.
Yes.
What is that like?
It's fantastic. It's a gift. I mean, Rob McClure, who was Tony nominated for his role as Chaplin, he's done Honeymoon in Vegas on Broadway. He did Noises Off, Avenue Q. He is one of the most dynamic performers and certainly one of the best comedians out there. So to get to share the stage with him is so much fun. And we met on stage. We met doing a production of Grease. He was Doody and I was Frenchie. So to get to, this is our fifth time working together, our second national tour together. I mean, it's fantastic. You have to know that if you're touring with someone, you have to know that you get along with them, because you travel with them, you work with them, and you live with them.
Right.
And luckily we get along really well, and we're having just a blast seeing the country and making them laugh.
And you probably can get insights into each other that only the two of you know about.
Totally. Like, some, like, we'll ask each other, like, what was going on? The other day I said to him, you didn't cross as much in this one moment. Did you forget? And he said, I thought maybe you said you'd gone to the gym, and I thought maybe your legs were tired, so I didn't cross. So it's like just little things like that where we know each other so well. And I was like, wow, that was very sweet of you, actually.
How neat. Well, now you've been a part of some other great productions, including Little Shop of Horrors. You mentioned Avenue Q. Mm-hmm. How did you get started in the business? I mean, what was your first, how did you get the acting bug?
My mother was a huge musical theater fan, and so I grew up listening to cast albums, and we saw all the movie musicals, and she took us to see musicals. I remember I think the first one I saw was Peter Pan at the Academy of Music in Philadelphia, which just 2 weeks ago we got to play there. So that was kind of an emotional thing for me to play in the first theaters I saw a show. But then I just started doing the school shows in high school. I just fell in love with this collaborative art, you know, where you get to work together as a team and put on the show, and everyone leans on each other and has to, like, support each other. And I remember after a show where I started getting complimented on my work by people who weren't just family members anymore. And I was like, oh, that's a good sign. Like, maybe, I don't know, maybe I can do this. So I went to school for theater and just started auditioning from there.
What would be your dream role?
Oh, gosh, you know, I get asked this all the time. So it changes, and it also, like, it's different, like, time periods. Like, someday I want to play Mrs. Lovett in Sweeney Todd. I've got some time yet, which is good, because I have that to look forward to. But that's just, someday I must play that role. God, there's so many. What I'm really looking forward to is doing another new work, because I've been in a position where I've played roles that other people have trailblazed and set kind of the mold. And I've had very generous directors that let me, you know, find my own thing. But you still, you have in your head the first time you saw it performed by someone else. So I'd love the opportunity to, from the ground up, work on a new role in a new show.
Well, now this national tour of Something Rotten, which opened in January of 2017, it also stars three of the Broadway people from the show, mm-hmm. and Rob and Josh, as you say, are the Bottom brothers, and Adam, who plays Shakespeare. What advice did they give you when you joined the national tour?
You know, not too much, because we had our own rehearsal process. It was doubly hard for them because they were making changes. There are some changes that were made. When a show's done on Broadway, you have this preview period where you're allowed to make changes. Like, you rehearse during the day whatever didn't go well the night before. Like, you try a new joke and go, okay, let's rewrite that, or rewrite that scene, it's not landing. And then what happens is you usually kind of run out of time where the previews are over and the show's set, you open, and that's it. Mm-hmm. And it's very common on tours for them to take moments that they always had a problem with and fix it. So it's not huge. It's nothing huge. Just there's one scene and there's a couple lines that have been changed for the tour, which is good. So if you've seen it before on Broadway, come see it and you'll see something slightly fresh. So they were rehearsing during the day new material and then performing the set Broadway run at night. So they actually did not have any space to give any advice because their brains were so full. But we had Steve Bebout, who was the associate director for Casey Nicholaw, with us during that whole rehearsal process. And then Casey came for a couple days. And they, you know, have been with the show from the beginning, so they knew what worked. So they can guide you towards what they need while letting you make the character your own. So they're very generous in that regards.
Absolutely. Well, Something Rotten is running now through Sunday, March 18th at Wharton Center in East Lansing. Tickets are still available at whartoncenter.com. Maggie, thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Another Cattlecast in the books. Don't forget to listen to our other podcasts, including Executive Edition and Reader's Roundtable, both of which can be found at Google Play, Apple Podcasts, and other outlets. I'm Mark Bazita. See you next time for another episode of Cattlecast.